Well, 20 years ago, a loaf of bread cost 70 cents. But today, a loaf of bread costs over $3. That means the price of food has increased 429% or so in 20 years. Wow. Well, it is true that incomes for some families have been going up as well. The incomes of many, if not most, have not gone up 429%. And thus we can say, with some accuracy, that the true cost of food is going through the roof. This leads us to ask, who will feed us when money will not?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 729th edition of the Food Chain Radio right here on News Talk Radio. And, of course, you could be tuned in on the Internet, too, among our friends down there in Perth who are tuned in, listening on the Internet. Wherever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Dave Michaels on the boards. Hello, Dave.
Glad to be here.
Folks, something happening here, and what it is ain't exactly clear. It appears from my elemental wet finger in the wind calculations that the true cost of food is really going through the roof. Now, I'm not talking about the price of food keeping up with inflation, which is to say the ever-diminishing value of the dollar. I'm just talking about the real, true cost of food. Now, when the value of food goes up and the value of money goes down, it is bound to have a profound impact on the hundreds of millions of people who do not have much money. Witness, for example, the Arab Spring revolts cursing through the Middle East, which are being sparked, in part at least, by the lack of affordable food. In fact, the world's poor have become a buffer for the world's food supply. When the price of food exceeds the poor's ability to pay, they are forced out of the market for that food. With their demand removed and from the market, the supply becomes more plentiful unless the price goes down. As the true cost of the true price of food keeps going up and the true value of money keeps going down, more and more of us will find ourselves in a position that our money will no longer buy enough food. And this leads us to ask, who will feed us when money will not? And who better to ask than our good friend Harwood Schaefer, a research professor of at the Agriculture Policy Analysis Center, University of Tennessee. Welcome back, Harwood. Let's see. Must have something going on here.
I can hear you.
Okay, gotcha. We had a switch that was missing there.
Okay.
Gotcha back. Let's see. The interesting thing about Harwood Schaefer is that he's not a real Aggie. He's a sociologist, right, Harwood? Well,
real sociology, my master's degree.
Well, we have a weird connection, it would appear. Maybe we could try calling him back. Okay, we're going to try calling Harwood back and see if we can pick up a better connection. But while we're making that connection, I'll give you a little bit of background about Harwood. He has a PhD in rural sociology, and he is a research professor now with the Agriculture Policy Analysis Center at the University of Tennessee. And what Harwood does in association with his fellows there is comments on what's happening in the world of agriculture as it relates to farmers in the countryside and we consumers in the city. He is a research professor. That's the title. And so today what we're going to talk with Harwood about is the relationship of money and the supply of food, because it appears from my elemental look at the price of food that it is indeed going through the roof. In 1990, a loaf of bread cost 70 cents. In 2010, it's over $3. So that's 429% increase in 20 years. And income, on the other hand, does not appear to have grown quite that much. As a matter of fact, in 1990, the average hourly wage, all things considered, benefits and all, was $16.63. In 2010, 20 years later, it's $18.93, for an increase of only 13.8% in 20 years. So it really does appear as though the true cost of food is going through the roof. I think we have you back. Carr, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. A little bit scratchy, but we're on the road now.
Okay, I can hear you clear.
Okay, good. I was just commenting, Harwood, that in 20 years, the price of food, the cost at the supermarket, has gone up like 429% or so. At least that's what a loaf of bread has gone up in that time. But the average wage income has only gone up about 13.8% in those 20 years. So thus, you know, when we can conclude with some degree of accuracy, I think, that the price of food is just going through the roof. Now, are you seeing something different than I'm seeing?
No. The price of food is going up. Commodities have gone up dramatically after being relatively flat for 30 years from 1980 to, say, 2004. Since 2006, the raw commodity price has tripled.
Wow. So what we're seeing then is the real cost of food is indeed going up.
Well, there are two things that happen. One, you look at the cost of the raw commodity is, and then you have to look at how much the manufacturer adds on.
Right.
I'm just looking up the numbers right now, and I'll have them in a couple of minutes. But basically, if you're talking about a loaf of bread, there only 5 cents on the dollar in that loaf of bread is farm gate price.
Right.
But it's processing and transportation. So a good bit of the cost is because the cost of oil's gone up and they charge you more for and all of those things. So that's a good bit. I mean, if you take a dollar's a $3 loaf of bread, there's only 30 cents, at most, 15 to 30 cents worth of grain.
Grain in the bread, right.
Right. I mean, at 5%, there's only 15 cents. So even if you double that to 30 cents, that, you know, you might expect the price to go up by 45, but actually, the commercial prices to the consumer's gone up much more than that.
Well, that's what I'm trying to get at. You know, there's the inflation, the normal inflation, which kind of lifts everybody when it gets right down to it. I mean,
right.
But this is the true cost is actually more than it was before. So we're actually paying more for our food in real terms. You subtract inflation. And the real cost is really going through the roof. Is that not true?
Yeah, for the bulk of the American population whose incomes have not kept up with inflation, that is true.
Well, even if your income has kept up with inflation, would it not also be true as well?
Probably even for those for whom it's kept up with inflation. Right now we're in an unusual time in terms of we've got prices in oil prices and grain prices.
Well, we're losing your connection again here. Maybe what we can do is try again after a break, Harwood. I don't know what kind of phone you're on, but it's not coming through at all. So we're going to...
I'll change phone... Go to a different phone.
Yeah, I think.
And let's see what happens.
All right, good. Let's try that. And in the interim, I guess it's time for a break. So what we'll do is take a quick break, folks. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're looking at the true cost of food going through the roof, not just the inflation cost of food, whereas everything goes up all the time as the value of the dollar keeps diminishing and going down and becoming worth less and less. we're talking about the real cost of food, adjusted for inflation, beyond inflation. Food is costing more and more and more. The price of a loaf of bread has gone up 429% in 20 years. The average wage has gone up 13.8%. So we're not, even if we're keeping up with inflation, we're paying more and more and more. So where is this going to take us when the value of food becomes so precious that money just isn't going to buy enough food anymore? Where is this all going to take us? That's the question on the table today with Harwood Schaefer, research professor, University of Tennessee, and you, right back after these messages.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, folks, the real cost of food is going through the roof, and everybody who shops for food probably knows that. So the question is, where is that rapidly rising price going to take us? And as the value of our money keeps diminishing and the true cost of food keeps going up, they're headed in the opposite direction, and it's going to be pretty interesting to see where this is going to take us. Here to help us find out, maybe look into the future, maybe find some answers, is Harwood Schaefer, research professor, Agriculture Policy Analysis Center, University of Tennessee. Harwood, why on earth is the value of the true price of food going up so quickly now?
The price of food is going up because it goes back to some policies that we established back in 1996 when we eliminated traditional farm policies where we had reserve stocks so that if there was a jump in demand or a problem in production, that we would have people protected by having available food. Because unlike automobiles, and we've seen, if Toyota runs out of parts, people just wait to get their cars fixed and or drive them the way they are. When it comes to food, you can't do that. And so you have to have stocks of food. And in 1996, some major economists, not including me and not including Daryl Ray, who I work with, and politicians decided that the government did not need to hold stocks, that instead we could let commercial firms like Cargill and Bunge and ADM, Louis Dreyfus, hold those stocks. And besides that, if there were any problems in one area of the world, that because we had a world market, we could get the food elsewhere. It turns out that their arguments and their assumptions are false. We found that out after they got rid of all of the stocks. So we don't have any, we don't have reserve stocks. So when, in response to the low prices that resulted from the 1996 Farm Bill, farmers invested in ethanol plants and in policies that promoted ethanol, you suddenly had the development of another demand for food. And then when we had production problems in Australia and in the former Soviet Union in wheat, all of a sudden the prices went through the roof because the traders knew that we didn't have any extra. And with the price of oil going up, you can produce ethanol profitably.
Wow. So you've listed a bunch of things there. You got weather in Australia and Russia, both of them big wheat, big grain producers, right?
Yes.
You didn't mention the increased demand for grains from the emerging economies of India and China. Did they have
actually that argument is overblown.
Ah.
That argument, those places have actually increased their own production and gone from net importers. Like India has gone from a net importer to a net exporter. So it isn't the Indian demand.
So that
in China, except for soybeans, China is self-sufficient in all of the food grains.
Wow.
So they're not a factor in the grain market. Now, in the soybean market, that's true. And the soybeans are used to produce the meats. But we've seen soybean production in Brazil go through the roof, and in fact, Brazil has been able to capture most of that gain.
So, and then China's buying up a lot of farmland in Brazil as well, so it looks like they've got plans to take care of themselves pretty good here in the future.
Absolutely.
So you mentioned biofuels. Biofuels are a big reason that the price of food is going through the roof, and the reason being we now buy grains to make ethanol out of them. And
right.
That, where that grain otherwise would have gone into the food stocks. Other things, what about panic purchases among economies? They get a sense that there's not going to be enough food, and they run out and buy a bunch of grain.
That the increases in stocks in other countries is almost immeasurable. There may be a little bit of that, but it certainly doesn't account for the major change. A greater factor are the fact that we have allowed what are called long-only funds, speculative funds, to buy into the grain markets. Now, traditionally in the grain markets, the traditional speculator who buys both long and short, the traditional speculator has position limits. That is, they can only buy so much because we don't want them cornering the market.
Right.
And so we've set position limits. But investment funds that are long only, that is, they assume that the price is going to go up in the future, so they're buying with regard to inflation, basically they're in a gambling mode, and they're betting on inflation, and so they buy these for future delivery a year or two down the line. They don't buy short ever, mm-hmm. So they never look at the fundamentals of the market, and they usually have a package of commodities of oil and metals and grains. So if they say they're going to hold 60% or 70% of their portfolio in oil, and the price of oil doubles, then they have to increase their purchases in grain to keep this portfolio that they guaranteed in their prospectus. So that when the price of oil goes up, they buy more grain and they push the price of grain up, even though the amount of grain available for people to eat is exactly the same as it was.
And that would relate to my next question then, which is, of course, what impact does the collapsing dollar have on this? And that would be pretty much what those long traders are betting on, is the collapsing dollar, right?
They're betting on the collapsing dollar. They're also betting on China's demand for oil.
Mm-hmm.
And the growing economies. Basically, we're close to peak annual production in oil, and you have economies like China and India growing, and they're demanding more fuel. And China, for instance, doesn't have a lot of oil. They got a lot of coal, but they don't have a lot of oil. They're like the United States. They have to import it.
Right.
And so they're betting that there will be greater competition for that oil. And so the oil prices go up as a part of this commodity mix that they're betting on. And that carries with it the price of grain.
Sure. And thus the price of food goes up. What about the price of oil and energy just in terms of production? Is that having an impact on food prices as well, because it costs farmers,
yes,
and ranchers more to power their equipment now?
Yeah, the farmer and the rancher are getting squeezed in the same way that the person who buys the loaf of bread. That is, all of the farm inputs have gone up. Fertilizer prices have gone up. Much of the fertilizer, at least the nitrogen fertilizer, depends upon fossil fuels to produce. It's made from natural gas.
Right.
So if to the extent that natural gas follows oil prices, then fertilizer prices go up, plus the transportation costs
for
all of those go up. The cost of producing all the pesticides and herbicides that they use go up.
And it seems like there's just a never-ending basket of reasons why the price of food is going up, and that's what we're dealing with today on The Food Chain. Michael Olson with Harwood Schaefer and you, right back. Well, folks, think of all the reasons. Weather, demand, reduced yields, biofuels, increased energy costs, trade shocks, panic purchases, oh my goodness, all kinds of reasons the real price of food is going through the roof. And as the dollar, or the value of our money, falls through the floor, we are going to be facing an interesting situation in which our money buys less and less food all the time, thus putting us, or at least putting many very poor people, in a tough situation. And that's what we're talking about today, is the situation that many in the world find themselves in. We're talking with Harwood Schaefer, who's a research associate, Agriculture Policy and Analysis Center, University of Tennessee. And that does, you know, the poor people of the world find themselves in an interesting situation in which sometimes they're being priced out of the food business. Right, Harwood?
That's absolutely true. In this last price run-up, we're in the second price run-up right now. We had a price run-up from 2006, peaked in 2008, started to go back down, and then this last fall has started to go back up. And with the planting problems this spring, the prices are starting with the rains.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we had a lot of rain, so you have both flooding and delayed planting going on, so that there's uncertainty about what's going to happen this fall in terms of harvest, so the price has gone up. And while in the United States, what has happened is, and the number of people on food stamps in the United States has gone up dramatically. Now, part of that's increase in the price of food. And the other is that a lot of people lost their jobs when the bankers gambled on our mortgages. And so that's part of the factor of those are the two factors in the United States. Around the world, there has been an unacceptable but a stable number of about 800 million people over the last 40 years who have been undernourished. And that number has stayed relatively stable, except starting with the price run up in 2006, that number jumped from 800 million people to the FAO approximates or guesses or estimates that the number went up by a little over 200 million to over a billion people. I've talked to others in the field who suggest that the number jumped to 1.4 billion people. So we've had almost a doubling by some estimates of the number of people in the world who are malnourished. And what that means is that we talk about development in the rest of the world, but if a child in the first 20 months from conception, if the mother is malnourished at the time of conception, and in that first 20 months from conception, if that child doesn't get an adequate diet, they have permanent physical and mental loss. That means we are destroying the future of those people for the next 40, 50, 60 years, whatever their lifespan is.
And thus we find ourselves in a real deep pickle. Now,
yes.
There are many who attribute the revolts in the Middle East, the Arab Spring revolts, the Jasmine Revolution, on the fact that there are so many people who simply can't afford the food anymore, and so they're just standing up and yelling about it, I guess. So really, this divergent of the real price of food and the value of money is the divergent courses these two things are taking is really having an impact on the world. Now, these poor people actually become a buffer, because when they're removed from the purchasing of food, they kind of take a huge demand off the world's food, and then price can go down. Is there a relationship there?
Absolutely. They are the buffer stock. We used to have physical buffer stocks, and we could go to grain and feed everybody. Now we don't have the grain as the buffer stock, so our buffer stock becomes how many hundred million people we put into malnutrition so that we can make ethanol or even feed the rest of us. I mean, to the extent that we buy meat and the meat is grain-fed, that cattle producer is competing with poor people for that grain.
Sure.
And if we buy that meat, then we're paying that cattle producer to compete for that grain.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we're all competing for the food when it gets right.
We're all competing for the food. And without adequate reserves, we're subject to shocks like production shocks that we have now. And then we're also vulnerable to demand shocks. Over the last century, we've really had four demand shocks. The rest of the shocks the more common shock is weather and supply.
Right.
And the demand shocks are World War I, and you eliminate production in Europe, and there becomes a great demand shock in the United States, and grain prices go up. World War II, we had the same thing happen. The U.S. becomes the production mechanism. You had 1970s when the Russians changed their policy. Traditionally, when they had a loss of grain production, they slaughtered their meat animals. And for some reason, and I have never read any annals of the Soviet Politburo and their decision making as to why they made the decision, but in about 72, they decided that they would go on the world market and buy grain rather than slaughtering cattle. And so you had the run-up in prices in 70 in what's called the Great Russian Grain Robbery. And that was a demand shock. And you also had, as a part of that demand shock, world institutions had a lot of petrodollars, and they loaned them to developing countries who were just coming out of colonialism, and that money was used to buy food, and that kept the price of food up until they borrowed more money than they could pay back, and then they couldn't do that anymore. So that demand shock disappeared, and we have hungry people. And then we have the combination of ethanol and the long-only funds driving the market today.
So there doesn't seem to be any lack of reasons why we have demand shocks, right? We have weather, we have crazy countries, we have speculation, we have everything that causes these shocks, one of which we're appear to be in right now. So when we come back from this break, we're going to talk about what we can do to mitigate shocks and hold the price of food at reasonable levels. It has been done before, and perhaps we can do it again. We're going to talk about that with Harwood Schaefer, who's a research professor at Agriculture Policy Analysis Center, University of Tennessee. So we will be right back after these messages. You can call if you wish with your questions at 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. This is The Food Chain. Welcome back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Harwood Schaefer. Today we're talking about the price of food and how it's just gone through the roof, both in inflationary terms, but in also in real terms. Even if our incomes have kept up with inflation, the real price of food has exceeded that. So in very real terms, it does cost us more to feed ourselves and more and more and more and more. And as we look down the road, as we see the price of food going up and the value of our money going down, you know, it's going to put a squeeze on everybody, as it is putting a squeeze on many of the world's poor, 1.4 billion of them going hungry right now because there simply is not enough food. So that is the issue on the table today. By golly, we have a phone call. We're going to pick up Teresa and have her have a conversation with Harwood Schaefer. Teresa, welcome to The Food Chain.
Yeah, hi, Michael.
Welcome aboard.
I wanted to say it's a very interesting show, and I was really happy that Harwood mentioned speculation in food futures as a factor in what's driving the prices up, because when they're buying ahead and then holding on to the food until the price goes up, it's forcing that. It isn't just that they're gambling on the fact that the price is going to go up, but it's also forcing that to go up. So I think that that was a really important factor to bring up.
Why don't we just make a law against betting on the future of grain, Harwood?
Well, many people have argued that these long-only funds should have position limits, that they should not be able to hold unlimited positions. That's true for the normal speculator. The traditional speculator provides liquidity in the market, and they're a very important part of the market. And some days they're long and some days they're short in their action. And so they buy when nobody else is buying and they sell when nobody else is selling.
And thus keep things moving, right?
And thus keep things moving. So the traditional speculator is an absolutely valuable and essential part of the process. The kind of speculator that is not very helpful is a fund that goes long only. And while the traditional speculator has position limits, the Congress and those who vote, let's talk about free market rhetoric, although they never follow it, they don't want anybody to tell somebody what they can or can't buy. Well, we do it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
We don't let the traditional speculator do it, and we think that the long-only funds ought to have position limits. Either that or they ought to be forced to, at the end of the contract, instead of rolling it forward, they ought to be forced to take delivery. And if they had to take delivery, they wouldn't be buying it. At the end of that time, they would clear their positions.
The farm subsidies are another way, though, that they hedge their bets. Where for with corn, for instance, we're subsidizing that at 4 to 10 trillion a year, and that's about the same amount that we're exporting. So really, we're paying for them to be able to dump that corn on other markets, on foreign markets, at under the price of production. So that's what's driven a lot of their local producers out of business.
That was...
Harwood?
Yeah.
I'm trying to get the right words.
Okay.
There's some truth to that in the past. In this present position, that is not true. Before 96, there were times when we did that. On the other hand, in those periods of times, we had a floor price below which we wouldn't sell the grain, and that provided a floor price for farmers around the world.
Which are we not doing, though? Are we not subsidizing, or are we not exporting?
We're not subsidizing in the same way, so that the way we do it doesn't work the same.
Well, I mean, it may not be the same money, but it's the same effect. I mean,
No, it's not. By changing the policy, it's not the same effect. When we changed the policy, what we actually did in 96 was let the price go below the cost, let the price stay below the cost of production and be sold on the world market, and it actually drove the change in the 96 Farm Bill, which eliminated most of the subsidies that you're talking about, and that drove the price down for farmers around the world in corn of about 35 cents a bushel for every bushel produced between 1998 and 2001.
And we don't do that anymore?
Yeah, we provide
insurance programs for farmers, and that's a whole nother program to talk about the impact of insurance programs. The impact of insurance programs is different.
Mm-hmm. Harwood, are we still subsidizing farmers to grow grains now that the price of grain is through the roof?
No.
We are not
subsidizing. No, I mean, we're not providing any different. We're providing the same direct payments to farmers that we provided when production was 5 years ago or 8 years ago.
But why are we providing money for them? Why are we paying them?
Because those who believe in unfettered free markets, who are the people who got us into the problem in the mortgage business, the same people believe that if we didn't manage the price of commodities by holding stocks and instead simply gave farmers a flat fee for their traditional production, then the farmers would adjust their production according to need. And so they put in what is called a direct payment and gave the farmers a direct payment. And we're still doing that direct payment since 1996.
Okay, I have to take a quick break, right back with Harwood Schaefer. And Teresa's on the line, too. Do stay tuned. Well, what do you think? Would it be possible to figure out how to mitigate the price, rapid price increases that we've been having in food? How could we do it? Harwood Schaefer might have an idea. Perhaps we can reestablish a buffer stock of grains that would mitigate these price squeezes. A root cellar for the world. Is it possible, Harwood?
It is possible. And when I was in Senegal this last month, President Wade, the president of Senegal, and many of the leaders of African countries who are suffering some of the worst hunger problems in the world are arguing that it's not what the United States and the GA wants, but the G90, the poorest 90 countries in the world, are certainly very serious in talking about making the holding of food reserves a legitimate public policy, and that goes against what the G20 or the G8 has been trying to do with the Doha round in international trade. Mm-hmm. So, yes, we could have some cooperative stocks, both national stocks and some international stocks, and some emergency food reserves if we had the political will. And right now, we don't have the political will. We're more interested in talking about issues that are not the problem right now. I mean, we talk about the federal budget, but the fact is that employment is more important than that. If we had more people employed, we'd have a lower deficit, and the same goes for food. What the politicians want to talk about and what the solutions are not necessarily the same.
That would be a surprise. Teresa, got a quick follow-up?
Yeah, if I can put in an individual solution to that, I think we could be doing the same thing that the speculators are doing with food futures. I have a friend who does home bread delivery of whole grain artisan loaves. And a few years ago, I helped him buy a delivery truck. Now I have 10 or more years of bread where the price is stable. Even though his prices have gone up, I know that I've got bread at, you know, for the indefinite future at the same price.
Well, Teresa, if you have 10 years of bread, I'm afraid some of it's going to get awful moldy by the time you get, get around to eating it. Harwood, let me ask you that. Teresa has a great suggestion here, and it's one of the things I've seen written about. Don't we need to encourage production by what you call smallholders?
Oh, absolutely. I've been listening to the ads for the farmers markets in your area, mm-hmm. and Metro Farm Production, and all of that is a part of the solution. And that provides, the more we have of that, the greater resilience we have in our marketplace.
Yeah, the less vulnerable we are.
The less vulnerable we are to these shocks. So, and people used to grow food in their own yards and used to can it. And it didn't matter whether the price of peas went up in the grocery store.
Because you had peas in the root cellar.
You had peas in the mason jars in the root cellar.
Yeah.
And with the size of lawns in many American yards, if we were to use in California, instead of using our water to grow grass, if we were to use it to grow fruits and vegetables,
We could feed the world.
We could feed the world.
Thank you. Harwood Schaefer, really appreciate you joining us on The Food Chain today. And thank you all for tuning in. Remember, you can comment on this subject on the forums at metrofarm.com. And now go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.